appreciate the word of the podium. So I was asked to speak about some topic of interest, and I thought that maybe, especially at Stern, where I know that many of you are science majors of one sort or another, it might be worthwhile to speak about DNA and halacha, the interaction between modern science and halachic applications, particularly in the context of Beis Din work. I first became exposed to the relevance of DNA identification in the realm of halacha when I worked as the director of the Beis Din of America back in the year 2001. So after the whole 9/11 tragedy occurred, it only took a couple of days after being shell-shocked that I started getting phone calls from rabbis and others within the community saying, what is the Beis Din going to do about the Aguna cases? I said, what Aguna cases? And they said, well, in the aftermath of 9/11, there are inevitably going to be cases of men who were in the building and whose remains will not be able to be identified because it was such a terrible catastrophe that many people's remains were incinerated, that they cannot be identified. And we know that the halakha has extensive discussions in the Gemara, particularly in the Maseches Yevamos, about how a Beis Din needs to make determinations when a husband is missing, even if he's presumed dead. If he can't be identified, then it's the job of the Beis Din to figure out what are the evidentiary requirements, what are the criteria through which a determination can be made that the husband had definitely died. The Gemara there distinguishes between two cases where there's a shipwreck at sea, and you have maybe a witness who sees that a man fell into the water, and that witness doesn't see the man emerge from the water. So the Gemara has a big kiddush. It has a big leniency that when it comes to identifications of a missing man, to determine that he's died, even though normally we require two witnesses for everything, certainly determination so that a woman who had previously been married is now free to remarry because her husband died, we would require two witnesses. But Mishum Iguna Kilubei Rabbanan, that we relax the evidentiary requirements in the case of an Aguna, that we would even rely on one witness who testified that they saw that the husband died. And that witness can be a man, it could be a woman, it could be a relative. We're very, very lenient, and one of the reasons we're lenient is because there's a chazaka, isha daiko mintsava, that a woman will be very meticulous herself not to rely upon the testimony of even one witness unless she is very certain that the husband has surely died, because the consequences would be if it turns out that the husband was really alive and she remarried, so then she's going to be required to get divorced from both husbands according to the Gemara, and any children who will go into the second husband will be mamzerim, they'll be illegitimate because she inadvertently committed adultery. So therefore, since a woman's going to be so careful not to just to rely upon any witness, then we can rely upon the testimony of one witness. But even that one witness has to have seen that the husband definitely died. If the husband just went into an area where most people would have died, but we can't say for sure that he died, so then the testimony is not considered to be sufficient. So if the witness saw that a man fell into the water, but the water was Mayim Sheh Ein Lahem Sof, it had no clearly demarcated boundaries. It was a large, vast ocean. And it's possible that even though the witness didn't see the husband emerge from the ocean, maybe the husband was thrust by the waves to some distance that was far away from the witness's vision, and the husband emerged in some other location. The Gemara gives examples of where this sort of thing happened. So therefore, even though most people who fell into the water and who were not perceived to have emerged from the water, even if it's a vast ocean, will have died, since there is a minority of people in that situation who survived. So we need something more definitive in order to allow an ishish, in order to allow a married woman to be declared a widow so that she can remarry. On the other hand, if it's mayim sheyeshla hemsel, it's a water that has clearly demarcated boundaries. It's just a small little lake like you have in the camp sometimes. And you can see the boundaries of the water, so that if somebody fell into the water and you watched it for a period of time, for whatever reason, the witness wasn't able to save the person from underneath the water, and they watched for a period of time and saw that the man did not emerge from the water, so then it can be concluded with a sense of definitiveness that the husband has definitely died, and then the widow would be allowed to remarry. So we had to start applying these concepts when it came to the determinations in the aftermath of the terrible 9/11 tragedy. Normally nowadays, when we speak about aguna situations, I'm very involved in trying to resolve aguna situations in my role as the Abbesden of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, my previous role as the director of the Abbesden of America, my continuing role at the Abbesden of America, very involved with promoting the prenuptial agreement so that there won't be aguna situations. But those are aguna situations which are really the newfangled aguna situations. Those are the situations where we don't have any question about the husband being alive. The husband is just is too much alive. And is refusing to give his wife a get. That's the modern day aguna situation. Marriage is functionally over and husband is refusing to give his wife a get. But the old time aguna situation that was the main focus of discussion, not the exclusive focus, but the main focus of discussion in the Gemara, were these cases of the husband's missing at sea, the cases where it was presumed that where the wife wanted to remain married to the husband. It was a happy marriage. They weren't at loggerheads with each other. They would have wanted to remain married to each other, but unfortunately the husband is probably dead and the wife is stuck because she can't be with the husband whom she loves because he's probably dead, but at the same time, we're not able to bring definitive proof that the husband has died. So we had to rely upon these categories. So we weren't talking about a shipwreck. We were talking about a building that, two buildings that that collapsed and also went up in flames because of all of the fuel that was charged, was discharged into the places of collision on the tops of the buildings. When the planes collided into the buildings, it caused a major conflagration. There were flames. There was a tremendous amount of smoke. So people died from the flames and the smoke. So the question was, what is the equivalent in terms of the identifications that we would make in the absence of a mayim sheyesh lahem sof, a man who falls into unbounded waters type of situation? So the Gemara talks about similar types of situations. The Gemara talks about what if the witness saw that the man fell into a kibshaneish, he fell into a fiery furnace. So if he fell into a fiery furnace, the Gemara equates that with Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Sof. We're seeing a man fall into water with clearly demarcated boundaries where the man didn't emerge from the water. Here too, if he fell into a fiery furnace, nobody survives. Nobody survives from a fiery furnace, except for Kananya Mishal Bazaria, but we don't rely upon miracles, Tosfos writes. Tosfos says that, you know, that we don't worry about that a miracle occurred. Yeah, if you find out about a miracle, fine, but you don't have to bring that into the calculation of a Bezdin analysis. We assume that a miracle did not occur. Therefore, you could declare the man dead on that basis. So we had the equivalent of Nafsof, Nafsof, Kishik, Kishanesh. If you knew that a man, at the time of, let's say, the collision of the first plane into the North Tower, which went into the first plane at approximately the 92nd, 93rd floor mark, I think the building was around 105 stories high. According to all of the documentary and the photographic evidence, it was clear that the plane hit the building in such a way that the top part of the building was severed from the bottom part of the building. So all the elevators would not have been in use afterwards, and all the stairways were not in use. So anybody who was above the 92nd, 93rd floor was effectively trapped. Either they would fall towards a certain death by having a descent in the air of 90 plus stories where nobody can survive such a fall, or they would have been consumed by the flames, so which would be a kibshaneish type of situation. So this is equivalent to nafalaso kibshaneish. So in a number of the cases, we were able to resolve the cases by relying upon testimony. Just like the Gemara says, you can rely upon testimony of one individual. The individual doesn't even have to be Jewish. If the person who is not Jewish is Mesiach Lepitumo, they're speaking just in the normal course. They don't know that you need this information in order to permit the wife to remarry. They think you're calling for insurance purposes or for other purposes. They're just telling a story. So we were able to collect evidence from Jews and non-Jews alike who were able to place various individuals, various men who were missing, at a location above the 92nd floor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center, saying, yeah, I spoke to this person. Sometimes it was the wife who spoke to her husband. I spoke to my husband, I spoke to my friend who was in the office. He said, yeah, here I am in the office, and something happened. There was a plane that collided. They're trying to get us out. So we knew, based on the testimony from that conversation, the person was there in a location where they could not possibly have escaped alive, and therefore we were able to permit the wives to remarry on that basis. But there were other cases where the men were not in a location where it would have been impossible for them to survive. They were in the South Tower where this, there was one passable staircase where a person could have gone down that staircase. Or there were situations where maybe they worked in the North Tower above the area of collision, but nobody spoke to them after they arrived at work. We're pretty sure that they went to work because they left home and they always went to work, but we didn't have any absolute proof that they had been at work because nobody spoke to them. We had one case where we had very strong circumstantial evidence. The post can speak about, can you rely, let's say you don't have a witness, but you have very strong circumstantial evidence. So the Truma Sadeshin wrote a response to him in which he said that maybe you can rely upon very, very powerful circumstantial evidence that the person was, the Gemara speaks about, you have a celebrity who goes missing and nobody hears from the person. Who is a celebrity in the time of the Gemara? A Talmid Chacham, obviously. We're getting back to that. You know, thank God. The big celebrities, the Talmid Chacham. So if it was a case where the person fell into unbounded waters, you already have a probability of death. And then you have a second probability that a big celebrity, if they ended up somewhere else, somebody would have reported about it. He would have found out about it. So maybe you can combine those two probabilities to create a super probability and say, on that basis, maybe you could say the husband was dead. Tosfos on the Gemara says, we don't rely upon those probabilities. But the Truma Sadeshin says, maybe that's only in those days where it would only apply to a celebrity. But nowadays, that the lines of communication are so much better. This is over 500 years ago. The lines of communication are so much better. It wouldn't only apply to celebrities. Anybody, if they were still alive, you would have heard from them. And some of the later poskim, like Tom Sofer, say that that's certainly true in our days when we have the postal service, and you can only imagine how much more that's compounded, you know, nowadays. But these were, you know, some of the considerations that we had to take into account. So there was this one case where the person could not even be identified as having been in the building because nobody spoke to them. So you could say it wasn't even Mayim Shalem, so, but we had strong circumstantial evidence. What was the strong circumstantial evidence? That every single day, the person took the subway. They took the subway with their Metro card. So if you buy a Metro card with cash, there'd be no way of tracking how the person used the Metro card that day. But the person was very meticulous. They kept everything very carefully recorded. That's why he worked in the World Trade Center. He was a bond trader, everything. He kept good records about everything. So he bought his Metro card with a credit card. So we had the credit card records. We were able to get the Metro card number. And then from the city authorities, everybody was very cooperative with the Besdin because we were all working together. There's sometimes tragedy unites people. It's unfortunate. We should always be united even without tragedy. But certainly at this time of great tragedy, everybody in the city was united. We had all the widows come to us, and they gave us authorization forms that they authorized us to speak to any city agencies, the Port Authority, the Manhattan Transit Authority, and so forth, to obtain whatever records were necessary. Nobody ever asked us for those authorization forms because there was such a spirit of trust and cooperation. I had all the forms. Nobody ever asked me to produce the form. I had it if it would have been necessary. So the Manhattan Transit Authority produced the records of when this Metro card was used, and we saw what time every single day this man used the Metro card records to go through the turnstile at the 42nd Street, at the 42nd Street Port Authority Station. So what was the time that the person went through every single day, including September 11th? And then we had another set of records from, I think, the Port Authority, because the Port Authority operated the World Trade Center on some level. And everybody who worked in the World Trade Center had swipe cards, and they had to use the swipe cards in order to get inside of the building. So we had records as to what time every single day this person used his swipe card to get inside the building. You say, why do I need the subway records then? You just look at when he went into the World Trade Center on September 11th and figure out how long it would have taken him from there to take the express elevator up to the 78th floor and then a local elevator up to wherever he worked, 95th, 96th floor. Why did we need the subway records? Because all of the records, all of the data for the month of September got destroyed when the Twin Towers collapsed. So the records were on site. It's hard for us to understand these things because we've come such a long way technologically. What do you mean on site? Like everything exists in cyberspace. But once upon a time, it would take time for things to be saved, to be backed up on a hard drive, off site, whatever. And everything, all the records for the month of September got destroyed. So therefore, we only had the records, the swipe card records, for the month of August. So we were able to make an algebraic calculation of how long, what was the average time that it took every single day to get from the 42nd Street Station to the World Trade Center when he would enter his swipe card. And what was the longest that it took him? And even if you calculated the longest that it ever took him, and you would assume that it took that amount of time, the longest amount of time on September 11th, it still would have gotten him into his office at least 2 minutes before the building was struck. He was probably there only a couple of minutes before the building was struck. So we had very, very powerful circumstantial evidence. But it's a big chiddush. It's considered to be something that is not so obvious based on the Talmudic sources that you can rely upon this type of circumstantial evidence. This is circumstantial evidence which is based on a pattern which a person generally follows that depends upon their action. That's called the Rova Tuloi B'maisa. It's a majority a majority supposition based on a person acting the way that they normally act. A lot of majorities are based on simply facts. Like we say, Rova Behemos Kasher Me. Most of the animals in the world are kosher. So that's based on a statistical reality. The animals don't have to do anything in order to be kosher. I mean, most of the kosher animals are kosher, not trefles, that they don't have physiological defects. But here, this is a probability, even though it is grounded upon very powerful circumstantial evidence that would require a mice, it requires the person to do something. That we would assume that because he's always traveled to this location, when he's gone through the Port Authority station, that he would travel to this location today as well. Maybe he wanted to stop at a store and buy his wife a present. Who knows? So it's not something that you can depend upon with the same degree of reliability. But then we discovered that there was another methodology in terms of identifying missing husbands. And what was that? DNA identification. DNA identification. What's DNA identification? So the Gemara talks about that there are simonim. There are signs through which you can identify a corpse. Somebody dies and you want to be able to identify that this is the man who died so that the wife will be able to remarry. So that's the context that the Gemara is talking about. So the Gemara seems to, if you look closely at the Gemara, at a number of places, so the Poskim point out, the Pri Megadim and others, that there seem to be three different levels of simon, three different levels of identification signs. There's a simon gerua, is a very low level identification sign. There's a simon benoni, there's an intermediate level identification sign. And then there's a simon mufa, there's a high level identification sign. So the fact that the person was tall or short, that's very low level, because there are many people who are tall and there are many people who are short. The person was wearing blue pants. Many people wear blue pants. If they're wearing green pants, still it's a color. It's not a very reliable form of identification to say that this must definitely be the person. Considered to be very low level degree of identification, we would not rely upon that type of low level identification science for the simon gerua. Then you have a simon benoni, that we know the person had a wart over their eye. They had a wart over their eye, okay, but if you had a population of 1,000 people, you probably find 3 or 4 people who have a wart over their eye. So that's considered to be an intermediate level of identification, but if it would be good enough, for example, to return a lost object. Somebody lost an object, they identified the lost object based on an intermediate level of identification. Yeah, there's a little bit of a crease on the left side of the pocketbook. Okay, fine, so we'll give it to you. That would be good enough for those purposes, but that's only on a rabbinic level that we rely upon that. But to identify a man as having died so we would permit the wife to remarry, that requires a simon mufa. That requires an ironclad identification mark. What is a simon mufa? Well, what's the level that you need a simon mufa? So there's an opinion of Rabbeinu Yerucham who says that it has to be really, really unique. To the degree, the way that he was understood by some of the Meforshim, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, and Rav David Ben Yechia, understood that it had to be that either nobody else would have such, it was so unusual that nobody else in the world would have such an identification sign, or that it, you can't imagine that anybody in the same country or in the same region would have the same identification sign. So that's a very high level of requirement in order to permit a woman to remarry based on a high level identification. So there was an early Achman by the name of the Maaseis Binyamin. The Maaseis Binyamin articulated the standard that I think is followed by most people. The standard articulated by the Maaseis Binyamin is that if the margin of error is less than 1 in 1,000 or less than 1 in 2,000, so then that's considered to be an ironclad identification mark. If you have a person has a unique identification that would not be found in one out of a in more than one out of 1,000 people, so then you would be allowed to rely upon it. So some of the poskim say, so for example, fingerprint identification, that no two people share the same fingerprint. Certainly, you couldn't find more than one in 1,000 people who have the same set of fingerprints, so you could rely upon that in the event that there would be a corpse that couldn't otherwise be identified. Why can't you just identify the person in terms of the face or the head? Well, sometimes there is no face or head. You just have body parts, and you have to just, maybe there are some fingers that are left over, and you can only make the identification based upon the body parts that you find. Certainly that's true when there's been a building collapse or something of that effect. And sometimes even if there would be a face decomposes after time. So that's why one would sometimes have to rely upon these forms of identification. It happens that some of the people who were on the lower floors who weren't able to get back in time, so their remains weren't completely crushed, and there were body parts that were able to be recovered that were more substantial. So we actually did have one victim where they found some fingers, and they were able to make a fingerprint identification. And on that basis, we were able to permit the wife to remarry. The truth is that in that case, the person was also on one of the highest floors where they couldn't possibly have escaped. And we did have testimony from one person that they spoke to them, so we didn't really need the fingerprint identification, but we had it anyway. So in this case of the fellow who had the regular pattern of coming into the office every single day where he couldn't, there was no testimony that had been in the office, just very strong circumstantial evidence, they also made an identification. But it wasn't based on fingerprints, and it wasn't based on anything that was physically visible. It was based on DNA identification. It was based on this scientific process where they take a part of a person's cell, they take a certain bone fragments or tissue, that is skin, that is recovered from the person, and this is the DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, and they look at patterns. Everybody has the nucleotides. There are four different nucleotide formations that people have in their cells, and the order of the nucleotides is different with every single person. It's 99% the same with everybody, but there are slight differences with different people. And based on those slight differences, if you look at a number of different samples and formations in the cells, it can actually be distilled through a scientific process. It looks like a spiral staircase with two full layers and the beginning of one more layer, like a double-eight sort of formation. And they're able to look at what is the specific formation, and they compare it. What do you compare it to? What in the world are you comparing it to? The person is no longer alive. So you can compare it to DNA samples in the person's toothbrush, in the person's shaver, in the person's comb and their hairbrush, and you can extract DNA samples from just the person's cells that were found in these different devices, these different objects that were utilized by the person. So that type of DNA identification is not visible to the naked eye, but according to scientific analysis, and this was really only being developed and perfected in the aftermath of 9/11, and a lot of the DNA science, a lot of the expertise in terms of making DNA identification really was only perfected in the aftermath of 9/11 because of the fact that people wanted the closure of having their loved ones identified. It wasn't only for halakhic purposes that this was being done. We actually had an arrangement with the New York City Medical Examiner's Office that whenever they would make an identification of a body, because there were about 3,000 people who were killed in the 9/11 tragedy, whenever they would make an identification of a body, they would send us the identification, the name of the person. And then if this person was somebody who was one of the cases that had been submitted to us, we worked on approximately a dozen cases, and then we could contact them for further details, and they would even share with us the file and show us the processes through which they had made the identification. They were very, very thorough, very responsible. We get every day a fax. This was a machine they used to have, where you would put in, you know, paper on one end, and then something would come out on the other end, and whatever. One of these old-fashioned things. And they would send us every single day a fax with all of this information. And this way we were constantly updated with respect to the identifications that were made. And sometimes they would say that they made the identification based on DNA analysis. And they would say what the level of probability was, what the margin of error was. And the margin of error was a lot better than 1 in 1,000. It's usually about 1 in 1 trillion. 1 in 1 quadrillion. I remember one case where they figured out it was 1 in 1 quintillion, it was such an unusual DNA, and they were able to make these comparisons. Now, the comparisons were not always made based on a direct comparison with the DNA of the individual. It wasn't always available, the DNA of the individual. Sometimes they would take the DNA of the person's parents. They would take the DNA of family members, and you could also make a very strong comparison of DNA because it won't be identical, but it'll be very, very similar, much more similar than with respect to non-related individuals. At this point in time, they could do DNA analysis. People do what's known as 23andMe. They do 23andMe, generally a very bad idea, for people to find out more about their genealogy. Discover, you know, the father's not really their father, and things like that. And they can make a determination with an incredible degree of precision to say, yes, this person is your first cousin once removed, this is your uncle, this is a great uncle, it's unbelievable, just based on the slight discrepancies and the slight variations in the DNA. They're able to make these determinations, and it's always accurate. It's always right. Whenever you track down the individuals, it always turns out, yes, this person is in fact the first cousin once removed. This person is in fact a grandmother. It's unbelievable how they're able to make these determinations. So that science was only first developing in the aftermath of 9/11. But we had to make a halachic determination. Is this considered to be a siman mufak? Is this considered to be an ironclad identification that we can permit a man to be declared dead and for the wife to remarry on the basis of this type of identification? So we had a meeting with the rabbis from the Bezdin of America at the time, together with various rabbinic experts from the Lakewood Bezdin. The Lakewood Bezdin was working on a case of their own. In their case also, they didn't have any eyewitness testimony that could place the person in the World Trade Center at the time of the collision of the terrorist plane into the building where this person worked. They did have eyewitness testimony. They did have a telephone conversation that took place. They had testimony regarding a telephone conversation that took place with this individual 5 minutes before the plane hit the building. But the person could have left the building within those 5 minutes. So therefore, they didn't know whether they could rely really on the chazakah, kaninsa kanoya, that the person had been there, so we assumed that the person would stay there. Is that necessarily true? People have meetings sometimes. There were people who had started the day in the World Trade Center and they survived because they left the World Trade Center for a meeting before the buildings were attacked. So therefore, they were looking for something more. And they had DNA evidence in their case as well, that had been taken from skin fragments that were found on the scene of ground zero of the debris of the 9/11 collision. So the question was whether this was considered an ironclad identification sign. Why wouldn't it have been? So we met that day, and I remember we met in a shul. It was Congregation of Derech El, which is the shul which is closest to the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. But of course, you had Stern College women doing shmira, you know, every single day. And we had an expert from the medical examiner's office, like there, I think it was Dr. Howard Baum was his name, who spoke with us to give. He was considered to be the top DNA expert, and we discussed. We had a rabbinic discussion about the nature of the DNA science. So one of the concerns was, it's not nearly nine. It's not something which is visible to the naked eye. Other types are identification. You see a wart in a person's skin, so you know that that's something you've seen before. So you look at it, and it's a visible identification sign. Even the fingernails, so you could look at a person's finger, okay, so a person's fingers, you look at a person's fingers, so, okay, the print is created through something which is physical, but this is something which has to be extracted through a very elaborate scientific process. It's something which is not in any way visible. It's something which lives inside of the cells. It's something from the chromosomes, so how is this something that you can rely upon as a siman? So that was question number one. Question number two, that one of the rabbis raised, I didn't fully understand this question. It wasn't the one that anyone considered to be all that substantial, but it was raised anyway, was he said that if you have like a quintillion types of amount of different mutations, that would presuppose that people had reproduced and duplicated themselves this amount of times, but the world is only 5,761 years old or so at that point in time. So how is it possible that you could have a quintillion human beings? So you got over that one. But the third question was, what about the fact that there's no single identification sign? What you have in the DNA strand is you have a formation of an order of nucleotides, and that order is different, the pattern is different each individual, but there's a ramah in the siman in Shulchan Aruch. In the chapter in Shulchan Aruch that deals with the identification of bodies in order to allow a woman to remarry, it's chapter 17, siman Yud Zayin and Eben HaEzer. So there's a Ramah that says that if you're dealing with a low level or even an intermediate level type of identification sign, it doesn't matter if you have many of them pieced together, you look at each one individually. Each one individually is not good enough. So even if you have a bunch of them, that still wouldn't be considered to be a Siman Mubarak. It wouldn't be considered an ironclad identification. So there's no single spot in the DNA that you can say is an ironclad identification. So in the end, a number of rabbinic authorities discussed these issues, including the late Rizal Menachemi Goldberg, Zatzal from Eretz Yisrael, including the head of the Choshen Mishpachol in Lakewood, Rabbi Eliyahu Levin Shlita Yibadlo Chaim Tovim, including our own Rabbi Willard, Rabbi Dayadov Schwartz, a number of the major rabbinic figures in our community and throughout the world, all thought about this. And what was interesting is that even before the 9/11 tragedy occurred, that this question about DNA identification had been submitted to one of the great poskim in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Shmuel Vozner, Zatzal. Rav Shmuel Vozner had written a tshuva in which he said that DNA identification can be used as a not as an ironclad form of identification, but if it's based on personal comparison with the missing husband, so then it can be viewed as karov l'siman mubarak, something which is close to an ironclad form of identification. So if you have other circumstantial evidence akin to Mayim She'en Lahem Sof, like the case of the husband who disappeared into the unbounded waters, where there's a probability of death, you knew the man was in the building anyway, and most of the people who were in the building above a certain floor perished. So then Vozner had said that combination could be relied upon. That's if it was personal DNA. If it's familial DNA, so Shmuel Vozner had said, familial DNA means that the comparison is made with another family member. So then he said, that's a Siman Benoni. That's an intermediate type of identification. It didn't sound like he held that you could rely upon that. The question was, why didn't he consider it to be a Siman Mubarak? Why was it not ironclad? So number one, you could say the science was first developing. Like Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was quoted by the Nishmas Avraham, who wrote a sefer on medical ethics and medical halacha. It's a famous sefer called the Nishmas Avraham. He had many conversations with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So he said, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, we have to see if over time this is going to be accepted scientifically as something which is 100% ironclad and reliable. So then we'll be able to rely upon it. But otherwise, we have to wait and see. So maybe part of it was waiting and seeing. But part of it also was that there was the following fear. There was a fear that if DNA identification would be considered to be 100% unassailable, then it might create mamzerus situations. That is, like in the case that I said, a person discovers that the next door neighbor was really their father. So then that would end up meaning that they would be a mamzer, a mamzerus. They would be considered illegitimate. They wouldn't be able to marry freely within the community if it turned out that the father, their putative father, wasn't really their father. This was a major concern that a number of the poskim had with respect to reliability on DNA, where you have to tread, that you have to tread carefully. It was also a concern, science is always changing, and what is considered to be acceptable and reliable today may not be considered to be acceptable and reliable 100 years ago. There was a long tradition of the Rabbanim, of many poskim, not wanting to rely upon blood type identification. Blood type identification would be, if a father is an A blood type and a mother is an A blood type, and the child turns out to be an AB blood type, so then that means that the father is not really the father, because an A father and an A mother can't produce an AB child. And if you have a father who's an AB, he can't have a child who's an O, and things of that variety. So sometimes when there would be cases about whether a father was really the father of a child that would be brought to the Bate Din in Eretz Yisrael for purposes of child support determinations, they would show that this father's not really the father. Blood type tests can show which individual is actually the father, but it can show who is clearly not the father. You know the mother's the mother because she gave birth to the child. You were there when she gave birth. But the father, if the blood type doesn't match, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit or whatever. So then he wouldn't be obligated in child support. So a number of the poskim, including Rabbi Biden Yosef, including Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, including Rabbi Yeshua Ehrenberg, said you can't rely upon these blood type tests in order to determine who the father is. Why is that? Because there's a Gemara in Maseches Nida that says that all of the red parts of a human being, the Shlosha Shufim Ba'adam, the father, the mother, the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it says, what does the father contribute? What does the mother contribute? It seems to indicate that the mother's contribution is all of the red parts of the child. So that would include, according to the Girsa of the Vilna Gaon, that includes the blood. So the blood only comes to the mother. It doesn't come from the father. So how could you possibly show, based on blood type examination, that the father's not really the father? So Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, who was the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel after the establishment of the Medina, was very upset about this. So he wrote in a letter, he says, Chabal Shibot Shemad Holech V'Kovei Shalomos. It's such a shame that while the science is becoming so much more developed, even though sometimes it makes a mistake, but it's pretty reliable. He says, we're acting like the ostriches in the sand, like that the science is not happening and the science is not relevant. But we look like simpletons, or worse, that we're just ignoring the science. He said, you have to pay attention to the science. So many did not want to pay attention to the science. So he said it contradicted the Gemara. Others said, it doesn't have to be a contradiction to the Gemara. You could say the main contributor to the red coloring, or to even to the blood, maybe to the blood plasma, is in the mother. But the father also contributes something to the blood. It's not necessarily such a contribution. But they didn't want to rely upon these types of scientific methodologies. And certainly they wouldn't rely upon it in order to cast aspersions on the father being the real father of a child, so that the child would not be considered to be a mamzer. We have a general principle that ro bilos hokin akarabal, that when you have a wife who's married to a husband, we say that even if she, God forbid, had an affair with another man, we assume that if she was also living with her husband, that the child came from the husband. There's a medrash in Parashas Naso that seems to indicate even if the child looks exactly like another man, we still assume that it came from the husband, and Hashem just orchestrated it that the child should look like the other man in order to reveal the fact that the woman was having an adulterous relationship. But really, the child came from the husband anyway. So some said, okay, so that's the reason why you don't have to worry about DNA. So Moshe Weiss writes, so maybe even with the DNA, Hashem just orchestrates it so that it'll be the DNA of the other man, even though it came from the husband. So you can maybe come up with such an argument. I don't know if Herzog would have liked that argument so much. But Rav Asher Weiss also makes the argument that when it comes to establishing mamzerus, it's a different standard. When it comes to mamzerus, when it comes to illegitimacy, so then you need two kosher witnesses. It doesn't matter if you have ironclad scientific evidence. If you don't have two kosher witnesses that testify about the fact that it's known that this child came from another man, in whatever way that testimony would be rendered, or you have the father's own admission that the child is a mamzer, it's called the din of yakir. When it applies and when it doesn't apply is too extensive a discussion for right now, but we have our own set of rules and principles, and otherwise we don't have to assume that the child is a mamzer. Rabbi Mordechai Willich Shlita is another point, which is that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes in his Tshuvos that let's say you have a married woman that can't have children through her husband, they're not able to conceive, but she wants a child very badly, so she receives artificial insemination from somebody else. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says, even if the artificial insemination would come from another Jewish man, the child's not going to be a mamzer because he wasn't the product of an intimate relationship. If it's only through artificial insemination, not through an intimate relationship, the child's not a mamzer. But Moshe writes, even if the father is a mamzer, let's say the father is a mamzer and has a child with a woman through artificial insemination, so that child will not be a mamzer. That child won't be a mamzer because he can only have a mamzer through an intimate relationship. So if it will exist, so even if the DNA matches another man, who says that there was an artificial insemination? Maybe it was just, very very well hidden from the world that the woman had artificial insemination, and maybe she had artificial insemination with this other man. So there are other ways of getting out of the mamzerus problems, but not everyone felt that you could get out of the mamzerus problems so easily. El Yashiv has the following question in here. El Yashiv has the following question in his Kovitz Shubis, in his set of responsa. There was a very contentious divorce case, and the wife had contended that the child didn't even belong to the husband that she was divorcing, and the husband was very shocked and outraged that there was such an allegation. But now the divorce was over, and there was a daughter that was born from the marriage. And the question was whether the husband turned to Rabbi Yashiv and said, maybe just so I'll have closure on this, even for purposes of knowing what my obligations are, maybe I should do a DNA test and see whether my wife was really telling the truth, that this child is not from me, it's from another man. So Rabbi Yashiv quoted from a Gemara in Baba Basra. There's a Gemara in Baba Basra that talks about how there was a man who heard his wife say once to her daughter, you should be more modest than I was, because I have 10 children from your father, and only one of them is from him. Okay. So when the husband died, he said, I want all my possessions to go to my one legitimate son. And then they asked Rabbi Bana. They said to Rabbi Bana, he's a great sage, they said, how should we make this determination? Which one is the legitimate son? So he said, have all of the sons go to the keper, the grave where the husband is buried, and they should all hit the grave with a piece of wood or something. And the one that receives a response of some sort from the grave, that will be the real child. So 9 out of the 10 sons ran to the grave in order to perform this this test, and one of them did not go. So he said, "Oh, how the grave have a low." So he said, "Kulu nixay dahi." He said, "Give all the possessions to the one who didn't go." So he seemed to have used this like Solomonic type of a test, that the one who was the legitimate son was the one who would not want to knock on his father's kever. So the Rashbam and that Gemara says this was a shuda d'daini. This wasn't like a real scientific test. It just showed that probably the father would want to give his possessions to the one son who had the best character traits, who wouldn't want to like hit his grave. But it doesn't mean that it definitely was the son. The Eliyahu Rabbi asks a question, that there's a story that's born in the Sefer Hasidim regarding Rav Sajidon. What's the story that's born in the Sefer Hasidim? The story is that there was a fellow who went on a trip. He went on a business trip to a far-off country, what they call Medina Sayam. He went up to a far-off country, Hong Kong, I don't know, and with his servant, and he left a pregnant wife behind. And the wife gave birth. She gave birth to a child. I don't know what happened to the wife. Maybe the wife didn't last. And then the time that this man, who was a very wealthy man, was leaving this world, and he said, "I'm giving all of my possessions to my son." Or he didn't have to say anything. That would be the halacha. The halacha is all his possessions would go to his son. And the servant who had gone with him said, "I'm the son." Like enough time had passed, I guess that the mother wasn't around anymore. And the servant said, "I'm the son," and the one who was the real son was crying and screaming that this servant is taking all of the possessions that would rightfully belong to him. So I think the king of the country, as the story goes, went to Rasajagon and he asked Rasajagon to resolve this matter. So Sajagon took a bone that belonged to the deceased, and he made two different bowls of blood. That he took blood from both the servant and from the one who claimed that he was the son, and in the bowl of the son, the blood blended into the bone, and when he put the bone into the other bowl of that came from the servant. So the blood did not blend into the bone. The blood remained separate from the bone. It didn't blend in together. So Sajagon said, "You see that the blood that came from the one that the bone of the deceased blended in, he obviously is the son, and therefore he should get all the possessions." So the Eliyahu Rabbi asks, "Why didn't Rabbi Bana utilize this test? Why didn't he utilize this test?" So some say, "Well, maybe it didn't exist in his days. It only existed later on, in the days of the Gaonim, the days of Sajagon." Some say, "Well, maybe he didn't have a bone, and it wasn't appropriate to dig up the grave of the deceased in order to take off a bone that would be nimble a mace, that would be desecration of a dead body." So there are explanations that you can give, but the Rashash, in his commentary to the Masechus Baba Basra, gives a different explanation. He said, "No, had they done the test, had Rabbi Bana done the test, so that would have definitively indicated which sons were mamzerim, which sons were illegitimate, and which one was not illegitimate. And in the meantime, each one had the right to assume that they were legitimate because of the principle of Rov Bilus Halkin Achar HaBaal, that when a woman gives birth, so we can assume that the children all came from her husband, from her lawful husband, and not from somebody else. And we don't want to upset that chazaka. We don't want to upset that supposition, that presumption in halacha, and cause people who are otherwise presumed to be legitimate to become illegitimate." So Rabbi Yashiv quoted this answer of the Rashash and said, "Don't mess with a good thing. Right now, your daughter is presumed to be legitimate because of the fact that we apply the principle of opulus hokinakaraba. But if you're going to go for this DNA testing, then it could be that you're going to have a real problem on your hands." He didn't necessarily follow the view that said that DNA testing is unreliable. Even according to the Gemara, Masechus Nida, that said that you can't rely upon blood typing evidence, that's if you're examining. Even if you're relying on that Gemara to make that statement, that's if you were making identification based on blood type. But DNA is based on cells and bones, which, according to the Gemara, do come from the father. So therefore, DNA presumably would be more reliable, even according to that argument. So Rabbi Yashiv didn't want to authorize the person to do a DNA test for finding out whether or not they're a mamzer, because if you don't do it, then you're allowed to rely upon the halakhic presumption that the person's not a mamzer. So I had this case. Somebody came to me and said that they always kind of knew in the back of their mind that their mother was married to, who she eventually got divorced from, was not really their father. She always knew, but halakhically, it was the Rabbanim relied upon the presumption, she was viewed as legitimate. She was already married, and she already had children, because the Rabbanim had paskin, she had nothing to worry about. She could assume that her halakhic husband was really her halakhic father. She can make that assumption. And she called me to ask me a different shiloh. Doesn't matter what the other Shiloh was, but towards the end of the conversation, she said, oh, by the way, I assume it's not a problem. I'm planning to get DNA testing just to get closure so that I can know once and for all that this other man was really my father. And I said, and how do you mind? I said, don't dream of doing such a thing. This is before I even knew that Rabbi Yossi, Baruch Shekivati. Then I found Rabbi Yossi said the same thing. Okay. So 23andMe can sometimes be very perilous. But what about in the context of identifying a husband? So in the context of identifying a man, a husband, to presume that he really died. So there, what about the fact that it's not visible to the naked eye? So Rav Zalman and Nechemya Goldberg pointed out that there's another standard of identification that the Shulchan Aruch and the Poskim speak about, the Gemara speaks about, that is even more reliable. You could even use this to put somebody to death. And you can't necessarily say, oh, because the person has a siman muvuk, they have a weirdly shaped nose, they have an extra limb on their body that less than 1 in 1,000 people would have, that you can rely upon that to put somebody to death. But if you see somebody and you witness the murder and you look at the person and say, aha, that's the man who committed the murder, because you're looking at them. You're not identifying the person in terms of simanim. You're not saying this is the person because I know that they have, you know, a sixth finger, you know, on their hand. You're not saying that this is the person because I know that this person has a nose which is exactly 4 inches away from the mouth, and that the eyes squint, and that the ears are the following length and the following width, and that the person's dental formation is exactly like these dental X-rays. You're not making the identification on that basis. You're making the identification based on tfiyasayim, based on the fact that I know the person. I know the person when I see them, right? I don't know how to factor doppelgangers into the equation, but we assume that as a general rule, that when you look at somebody, yeah, it could be somebody who looks like, you know, a little similar. I've been told that I look like, you know, a certain, you know, famous celebrity. I forget the name. But I'm sure I don't look exactly. I'm probably better looking. I don't look exactly like him. Exactly like him, you know. So there are no two people who look exactly alike unless they're identical twins. But identical twins can share the same DNA too. We assume if you're identifying people in a rubble, it's not. If you had a case where two identical twins are missing, okay, you'll have a problem. But otherwise, that you can rely upon the identification. So he says you're relying upon the uniqueness of that individual. It's not because you're measuring any particular physical aspect of the person's face. You're relying upon the fact that there's something unique about this individual. And so he says that uniqueness doesn't have to only be expressed in terms of the fact that you're looking at a face and the face happens to be unique. The person can also be unique in terms of having a DNA coding in their cells, which is unlike that of any other person. So therefore, he felt that this was something that should be relied upon based on the principle of Tfiyas Ayin. And that also was the conclusion Rabbi J. David Bleichlita just wrote a very long book about DNA. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. And he comes to the same conclusion. He comes to the same conclusion, even though he presents it as an argument with Rav Zalman Nechemya. But the argument that he has with Rav Zalman Nechemya is a very nuanced, picayune argument. Rav Zalman Nechemya said, yes, we're relying on Tfiyas Ayin, that the Siman Muvak is the fact that it's Tfiyas Ayin. Rabbi Blake says, no, it's not that the Siman Muvak is the fact that it's Tfiyas Ayin, it's that it's not a Siman Muvak, it's Tfiyas Ayin altogether. But I don't know, to me it comes down to more or less the same thing. And that you're relying upon the fact that it is Tfiyas Ayin. So that resolved that question. What about the question about the fact that it's not a specific spot in the DNA that is something which is exceptional, but rather it's the whole formation? Well, Tfiyas Ayin also is the whole formation. It's the whole picture. You look at somebody and it's not a specific aspect that you're looking at. It's not a specific siman. You're looking at the whole gestalt. So it's the same thing with the DNA. And furthermore, you can say, and this was an argument that Rabbi Eliyahu Levine and others made, that the siman itself is the Seder. The siman is not a specific nucleotide or a bunch of nucleotides together. The siman is the order, like we're about to celebrate the Pesach Seder, right? So it's about the Seder. It's about the whole order, about how you do everything together. It's the whole combination is the siman. That it's not that I have a bunch of simanim that I'm putting together. The siman is the order itself of the DNA coding is considered to be the siman. Besides the fact that if you have one siman that itself has a number of different elements to it that make it, in its combination, very peculiar. Like the Truma Sedeshin speaks about a case of a person who had a closed eye and a scar on top, and there was pus coming out. So even though these are three different simanim that the Truma Sedeshin would normally say you can't rely upon, he said when they're all combined together, that this is the characteristic of the eye, so then that's considered to be one siman for sure. It's considered to be a siman mukbuk. So therefore, the consensus of the posting was that you could rely upon DNA identification, and we must have had four or five of our cases, maybe even more, were included as part of our identification of the bodies, a DNA determination, and the standard of Rav Shmuel Bozner was also satisfied, because Rav Shmuel Bozner's standard was that you can't rely upon it alone unless you have other circumstantial evidence. Well, in every single case, we had other circumstantial evidence. We were able to place the person through eyewitness testimony in the building itself. That would be create at least a probability of death. Even in the case of the person who was not seen by anybody in the building and not spoken to in that day, we had the very strong circumstantial evidence of the metal card records and so forth. So we always had the very strong circumstantial evidence. What about the fact that in certain cases, the DNA identification was not made on a comparison with a person's own DNA, but on familial DNA, which Rabbi Bozner said is only a siman beinoni. So Rabbi Mendel Sendrovic, Shlita already pointed out in the tshuva that he wrote on the World Trade Center tragedy, Rabbi Sendrovic said that if what we're relying upon is the fact that the margin of error is much less than 1 in 1,000, it's 1 in 1 billion, so the difference between when you're relying upon DNA of the person himself or DNA of a family member, is that instead of it being a margin of error of 1 in 1 trillion, it'll be a margin of error of 1 in 500 million. So he said, 1 in 500 million is also pretty good. Why did the Maaseh Binyan give this distinction between 1 in 1,000 and 1 in 2,000? Which is it, 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 2,000? So at the time of the DNA tragedy, the time of the World Trade Center tragedy, when we were discussing some of the issues relating to freeing the Agunos and making these Aguna determinations, so there was a forum, there was a symposium that was organized at YU, and a number of Rabbanim spoke at that symposium, including Rav Shechter Shlita. Rav Shechter at that time said that the 1 in 1,000 works when you have less than 1,000 people who are amongst those who are missing. If you have 1,500 people who are missing, and then you have somebody who has some type of an ironclad identification that's found in 1 in 1,200 people, it's not going to be good enough, because it could be you have 1,500 missing. So it could be that there are two people who have this type of identification mark. So that's why, if you have, presumably, that's what the Maaseh Binyamin probably meant. He meant that if you have a tragedy where 1,800 people are missing, so then it'll have to be 1 in 2,000. He didn't envision that you'll have a tragedy with 1 in 3,000 people missing. So in the case of the World Trade Center, the margin of error would have to be at least 1 in 3,000, but it certainly met that standard. So right now there are two other areas where it becomes useful. I think I have, 3 minutes or something like that?
Yeah.
No, I have 30 seconds. So the other areas where it is, I was looking at the clock over there, sorry. So the other areas where it becomes useful is now they have mitochondrial DNA, which is a type of DNA that only comes from the mother. So in terms of establishing Jewish identity, they determine 40% of Ashkenazi Jews share one or four different strands of mitochondrial DNA that come from four mothers from like 1,000 years ago or so, the new Abba Imams. And if a person has that, so it can be used, David Lau has written about this, and Yitzchak Yosef, together with other circumstantial evidence of Jewishness, this is now a big issue with the Russians, the Ukrainians, and so forth. That's something that could be taken into account, because it also creates a very strong presumption. We don't know if they're going to find some tribe in Australia where everybody has one of those strands as well. But right now, there are very few non-Jews who have that type of DNA, and it's mostly the vast preponderance of people who have it are from the Ashkenazi Jewish community, so therefore that is something that also can be used in a good way. And the other way that we've been using DNA identification in a positive way is some people who don't know for sure that, or can't prove that they're Jewish. They were adopted by somebody, and they were told their birth mother was Jewish, but they can't prove it with absolute veracity, and maybe you can't rely upon the adoption agency completely. And through 23andMe, they're able to track down who their birth mothers or birth grandmothers really were, through, you know, finding common cousins and things of that variety. It's kind of like a little bit scary, so people can't really have closed adoptions anymore completely, because 23andMe will probably eventually out everybody. This also has been a very useful tool. So like anything else, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has created unbelievable, you know, scientific data in this world. It's our job to, you know, uncover all of it to do good according to halacha, and to, you know, so may Rosh, stay away from the bad, but I say tov, and use it only for the good.